Your optimism makes you an idiot.
What did you call me?
An idiot.
No, an optimist. Don't you ever call me an optimist again.
Today on Real Lit, we're having ourselves an existential crisis with zombies. I'm really sorry that I called you an idiot. That makes me feel bad.
It's called acting, Mackenzie. I don't take offense to it. Welcome to Real Lit with Mackenzie and Steven. May I just say, it's good to have you back in the studio.
Oh, thank you. I did everyone's favorite thing in the world, moved houses.
Yeah, not like that's time-consuming or anything.
Yeah, no, did it all in a day.
Either way, we are back, and we're going to fall back into our regular schedule.
And you, my friend, have been very, very busy. On your own podcast.
Yeah, well, I couldn't keep this studio empty. So,
of course.
Had to do it alone.
Yes, and his new podcast is called Shelf Criticism.
It is indeed. Matter of fact, it's the fault of this film. I went rifling for zombie strippers in my DVD cabinet and realized I have like 500 DVDs. It's ridiculous. And I just already kind of been bitten by the podcasting bug. So I thought, hey, what if I just randomly grabbed discs and talked about them? Because I'm fascinating. People want to listen to me anyway. So here we are, Shelf Criticism. But I am glad to be back and have someone else sitting in front of me. And your opinions, I'm sure, are far more sage than mine. So.
Oh, I wouldn't say that, but.
I totally would.
Oh, if you want to continue to be the most amazing, cool listeners that you are, you should give Shelf Criticism a listen as well in that Stevens podcast. And we'll click a link on our page for that.
I paid her to say that.
After I called you an idiot. So today we are discussing Eugen Ionesco's 1959 play Rhinoceros in the film Zombie Strippers, which does exemplify certain motifs and themes of Ionesco's play, but, well, all I can say is that it was a personal adaptation in optimistic terms.
Yeah, for starters. I mean, the filmmaker exchanged rhinos for zombies. Other than that, it's totally the same story.
Yeah, identical, right? Now, it is interesting that they played off the author's name, Ionesco, for the main antagonist of the film, Ionesco. So there are little things like that that I thought were very interesting. But other than the quite literal name changes, I mean, I can't find really any plot.
Literally, it's the zombies, right? The zombies are the rhinoceroses. I don't know how to pluralize that.
Rhinoceroses.
I think it's rhinoceroses, but I want to be all fancy and make it Latin plural. I'm going to say rhinoceri. It just sounds better. So the zombies, instead of rhinoceris, everybody wanting to be a zombie, as I'm assuming you wouldn't want to be a rhinoceros.
I wouldn't think so, but I mean, the play people made it sound pretty great.
Except for the stepping on the cats part.
That was depressing. And the strippers, they could represent the potential of that deadly desire that we have for power and influence or destruction from envy or lust, admiration. All of those things that the strippers really go for that are very superficial and materialistic in life. You see that in the play Rhinoceros, but I also might just be grabbing for straws there in the film.
Well, the film does deliberately throw out a whole bunch of just random philosophical references. And in a way, a lot like The Matrix does, only The Matrix does it intelligently. And when I first watched this film a long time ago, I was like, oh, wow, I'm picking up on all these little, I don't want to call them Easter eggs necessarily, but these allusions to philosophy. And I thought, oh, that's so clever. This guy knows all that. I go back and watch it, and I realize, like, dude took a intro philosophy course and just threw a whole bunch of ideas in with a strip tease. Right.
And there are certain quotes from the film that I really enjoyed, like thinking thematically about the themes of conformity and individuality. There's this one moment where a woman says, "It's my duty to conform." And another woman replies, "No, your duty is to be an individual." And so I think, you know, that's a really strong quote. That's really strong thematically. And there were little tidbits like that throughout that I really enjoyed. But it was almost overshadowed by everything else. Even the thought of this quote from the film is the luxury of not having to think for myself anymore. And thinking of not thinking as a luxury, I feel like that's really relevant to today. You know, this film was 2008, but thinking in 2024, AI, that kind of doing thinking for us. Do we really want that? Does that make our lives any easier? Is it worth it? So I think those are some good questions that arise from the film.
Yeah, and you did mention Ian Esko, who, by the way, big nod to Robert Englund, a.k.a. Freddy Krueger, by far the most recognizable face in this movie, unless Jenna Jameson is, and that says more about you than anything else. Yeah, Ian Esko, of course, Ian Esko, the playwright we're talking about with Rhinoceros. I do want to throw a quick disclaimer out. If I say Ionescu, it is because I'm a huge WNBA fan and Sabrina's my girl. So go Team USA, go Liberty, and I apologize. It's Ionescu for our playwright. There is Berange. Forgive me, you French-speaking people. Je ne parle pas français. Berange or Beranger is the protagonist, would you call him, in the play?
You know, I call him the main character. When I'm writing out my thoughts, it's hard for me to call him a protagonist, but I will go ahead and apologize. I'm going to have to call him Beringer because my Southern voice, it just...
We'll forgive you. The French won't. But the French aren't going to forgive anything. Speaking of French, this whole thing takes place in Sartre, Kansas, or as they call it, Sartre. Sartre. Jean-Paul Sartre, of course, the famous existentialist philosopher on being and nothingness. We talk a little bit about this play being Comedy the Absurd. Probably the best absurdist play that I know of is No Exit by Jean-Paul Sartre. Fantastic piece. There's also Major Camus, a minor character. And again, forgive my pronunciation, but of course, that's Albert Camus, who is, in my book, the best of all the existential slash absurdist philosophers. One of my favorite writers. Also a minor character named Dr. Genet, who is obviously representing Jean Genet, who is one of the absurdist playwrights that we think about. If you get a chance, The Balcony. Wonderful, wonderful play. And then, of course, the other major character, whose name I guess is significant, is Madame Blavatsky, who is a strange character that we will come back and talk about quite a bit. But, of course, Madame Blavatsky, historically speaking, was the founder of a group called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which is a quasi or semi-religious philosophical kind of movement. If you are a literary buff like we are, little guy by the name of W.B. Yeats, some of you may have heard of, one of Blavatsky's ideas was that history is cyclical or operates in gyres. So turning and turning in the widening gyre.
Yeah. If you want to go deep down a rabbit hole, you should look that up.
Very deep down a rabbit hole. I do just want to point these out. Some of these other names, they have nothing to do with existentialism or philosophy, I guess. But the guy who was bitten and manages to escape and spread the disease is named Lieutenant Bird Flu. That is B-Y-R-D-F-L-O-U-G-H, but clearly bird flu was what we thought at one point was going to be the breakout disease that killed everyone. Nobody had heard of something called COVID, but yeah, a little nod there. And it's interesting it's in 2008 too, because I do remember this. The talk was of the swine flu at that time,
right?
Not bird flu. But either way, I think that would have resonated with the audience. There is a stripper called Gaia, and Gaia, if you know your Greek mythology, is the personification of the earth. She and Uranus birth the Titans, who would eventually birth the gods. And then, this has nothing else, but I just have to mention it. One of these soldiers, who, by the way, runs around in like a camouflage bikini top the entire time. Her name, according to the credits, is Sassy Sue.
I would like to point that out while we're on it. Even the female doctor, can't remember her name right now, a beautiful blonde actress. She, even when she comes in first, she has a very low neck, tight top under her lab coat. And I'm just like, wow.
It's called Zombie Strippers. What did you think you were getting in for?
Yeah.
The top billed actress is a pornographic actress. So you're lucky it was as tame as it was, I would dare say.
2008.
So normally one of our first segments is adaptation history.
And honestly, I am wondering how on earth this idea derived from the reading of the play. I mean, I would be really interested to see the train of thought that went through Lee's head when he, I guess, read Rhinoceros and said, I'm going to make this movie about zombie strippers, because that makes sense.
I mean, I'm all for loose adaptations and inspiration and playing fast and loose. This was pretty wild. I will say this about Jay Lee. Found this on his Rotten Tomatoes page. Horror film writer and director Jay Lee was born in Los Angeles and began working in the film industry when he was only 19. When he learned the ins and outs of movie making as a production assistant, location manager, and other odd jobs in small productions, Lee was eventually able to begin working on his own projects, which he is often in nearly every aspect of, from writing and directing to the cinematography and to the editing. Let's just stop there. That might be one of the problems with this film. get some more sets of eyes to say, hey, dude, this is not going to work.
Yeah.
I'm going to skip just a little bit of his biography. Of course, he works with his sister, Angela, apparently. So he and his sister produce films. And then we get to the point in his bio where we get to the current film under consideration. The Lees took a more kitsy, exploitative turn with Zombie Strippers, a comedy horror with socio-political undertones, starring adult film star Jenna Jameson as the zombie stripper who shakes up a strip club run by horror film veteran Robert Englund. So his bio, in many ways, revolves around Zombie Strippers, as well as a couple others that are, I mean, I've seen The Slaughter. It's, unless you are a completist and want to watch every bad horror film ever, don't watch The Slaughter. It's worth noting about four of the actresses in this film are also in The Slaughter. It is worth noting that Zombie Strippers is his highest rated film on Rotten Tomatoes with a whopping 38%.
Nice.
But if you are a Lee fan, say you love Zombie Strippers, I've seen way too many of his films. I didn't realize it. The Slaughter, as I just mentioned, Alice Kills, which is a really messed up take on Alice in Wonderland, House with 100 Eyes, and then there's one that he wrote but did not direct, and it's the best out of the bunch, which is not saying a lot. It's called Primal Rage. If you ever wanted to be attacked by a angry Bigfoot as you were camping, it's your film. Looks like he's still working, but pretty much just as a cinematographer. I guess before we move on to the next segment, we should probably shout out the other recognizable actress who would not have been at the time. But we have a character named Jessie that we're going to talk a lot about as well, played by somebody named Jennifer Holland. You may or may not have heard that name. She's married to a guy named James Gunn. Might ring a bell. Guardians of the Galaxy, DC. And she's currently playing the character Amelia Harcourt, who's kind of like one of those S.H.I.E.L.D. agents in the MCEU moving in between these films. She's been in Suicide Squad, Shazam, Black Adam, Peacemaker.
You know, unfortunately, her character, Jessie, in this film is just not good. Not a great character, not a lot of depth there. And she's supposed to represent, I think, some depth. And it's that absurdist lens of where every character is absurd, everything they say is kind of absurd, nothing comes full circle. And so for my close read on the play, Rhinoceros, I'm going to look at the absurdism. And absurdism is the philosophical theory that the universe is irrational and meaningless. So very bleak outlook. But it states that trying to find meaning leads people into a conflict with the world. And it's clear not only from this play, but his other works as well, that Ionesco focuses on the motives behind the absurd. And we fit right into this time frame of absurdism because most absurdist plays and other works were produced generally from the 1950s to the 1970s. And they present and explore the absurd nature of existence by being themselves absurd in form, plot, or both, with generally extravagant characterization and imagery in the written works. So this focus on absurdism differs from existentialism a little bit, because existentialism states that we must create meaning in life to have it, while absurdism focuses on the conflict between meaninglessness of life and the humanly inherent desire to create meaning. I also like the slight nod in Act 1 in Rhinoceros to Socrates, a forefront philosopher on the functions of human thought and social motivations. So I just think they talk about Socrates' cat in Act 1, and I think his audience at the time probably would have been a lot more privy to making that connection than we might today. And I want to focus on a psychoanalytic reading of this absurdism as seen in the main character, Beringer. Again, Beringer, I guess, you would have to consider the protagonist. It's really hard for me to consider him a protagonist because he's very negative the entire play until the very end of Act 3.
Have you seen any other French cinema or theater?
This is true. This is true. And there's also not a clear antagonist to me, really, in the Rhinoceros. They're all just people. And so I think that's one of the parts that makes all the themes so prevalent and universal to humanity is that there's no hero or villain necessarily. And psychoanalytic criticism calls for the understanding of the unconscious or repressed thoughts and emotions in order to understand the human life experience, our culture, education, language, and ultimately just society as a whole. But of course, societal norms differ based on culture and geography, government. So when looking at the text, it is essential to note that this play is written post-World War II by an author who grew up mostly in France, was born in Romania, So there was a frightening rise in fascism and a real fear of dictators such as Hitler and Nazism, dictators running the world in the near future. This was a real fear for UNESCO at this point in time. So thinking about Hitler's incredibly horrific ideas that there's a certain culture or race or social hierarchy that could lead to some type of utopia directly, this impacts the psychology behind UNESCO's play Rhinoceros. I'm going to take a certain snippet out of each of the three acts in the play regarding Berenger and how his character communicates this theme of individualism throughout the play as an observer. Because Berenger really is an observer for most of the play. He only observes and doesn't really form a passionate stance until the very end, which is ironic because while he seems not to care about the universal conformity around him at first, he slowly transforms into an advocate for individualism. So at the beginning, where he's like, no, no, nothing matters, life is just monotony, all of a sudden at the end, he makes this super emotional dramatic turn that everything about life matters, and we need to hold on to our humanity no matter what. In Act 1, Jean is very blunt with Berenger and states, quote, "You don't exist because you don't think. Start thinking, then you will." And he also says to exercise the weapons of patience and culture, the weapons of the mind. So in the beginning of the play, Berenger really could care less about culture, philosophy, or anything much outside of his drinking habit. And his friend Jean, I really like him because he's like, let's go see a play. Let's support the liberal arts. I'm like, yes, let's do that now. And so he's like this character of monotony. And while he detests it, he seemingly doesn't want to do anything about it either. He detests his job. He detests the cycle of every day. But then he doesn't want to put forth any effort to change it for the better. Then in Act 2, as the rhinoceros epidemic continues to grow and those closest to him begin transforming into rhinoceroses, Berenger becomes intently aware of his individuality and begins to fear his potential lack of choice in becoming a rhinoceros at all. And so this would be a good point to mention, if you hadn't read this play fully, everyone around him starts turning into a rhinoceros. They get a bump on their head, then their skin becomes greenish gray, and moments later they're a rhino. So absurd.
It's trampling cats.
Yeah, trampling cats. So sad. I feel like Berenger becomes intently aware of his individuality at the point when those closest to him become rhinos. It seems very unreal to him until those he actually seems to semi-care about turn into rhinos. And I feel like this is a good metaphor for how we can feel that expectations often overpower our choices at times in life. Suddenly, while Jean is transforming into a rhino, Berenger has an epiphany. And this is a quote from the play. "You must admit that we have a philosophy that animals don't share, and an irreplaceable set of values, which it's taken centuries for human civilization to build up," end quote. And so that quote from Berenger is very different from the beginning, where he didn't want to think and didn't want to take in anything about life. And really, the realization that Berenger has come to is that the power of choice is really what makes up the essence of humanity. And by stripping away the power of choice, it strips the meaning of being a human. And again, a nod here in 1959 to those fears of fascism post-World War II. However, still relevant today, that fear of losing choice. And in Act 3, by the time all those around Berenger have joined the herd, he actually calls himself the monster now. And the play literally states that he, quote, "suddenly snaps out of it." And Berenger exclaims, "I'll take on the whole lot of them." He claims that he is the last man left and refuses to surrender. This moral and emotional battle that Berenger has during the final monologue and act is, metaphorically, the battle that we all go through. It doesn't matter the culture, geography, race, sex, or anything. We all struggle in some ways with the monstrous sides of ourselves and the view that we have of our character or our lives. So I found this transformation and chaos of Berenger going between viewing himself as a monster and then as a strong individual, the most human act within the entire play. Because after all is said and done, We all have strong moments, weak moments, absurd moments. Despite any differences we have as humans, we all have in common that we live with ourselves 100% of the time. And we see Berenger having that struggle in his mind, in his beliefs, in his culture throughout the entire play.
And it's interesting that the counterpart in name in the film sort of has the same struggle. She resists wanting to become one of the zombies. But in the end, you know, she walks out and they mistake her for a zombie and shoot her anyway, right, which of course is a nod to Night of the Living Dead, you know, the original zombie film. But she also kind of resists, I guess, in some ways, of becoming a monster. But I don't know. It's weird. She sits back up and she's like, what does she say? Isn't it beautiful? Or
she thinks she's pretty now. She says, like, aren't I beautiful?
Yeah, because she's covered in blood and just been shot in the head.
Right.
I don't know. Who knows? Because they turn around and blow the rest of her head off at that point.
And I guess it begs the question of, you know, the theme of individuality, I feel like, is often coupled with the theme of inevitability as well. And how much of those, how much of your individuality can be infected by inevitability?
I just think we're reading too much into it.
Literary really, scholars.
What do you youngins say these days? It's not that deep.
Yeah.
It pretends to be. Yeah, we're kiddie pool depth here. But speaking of getting deep after that, we're going to take you back to class for just a moment. And I'm going to talk about my two favorite literary critics of all time. And I'm joking here. Deleuze and Guattari. If you have done any sort of work, really, in not just literature, but psychology, philosophy, they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. You realize their prose is impenetrable and sometimes a little difficult to understand. But there is a quote they have from their 1972 book, The Anti-Oedipus. And I'm just going to read the quote and do my best to explain it. Absorbed, diffuse, imminent death is the condition formed by the signifier in capitalism, the empty locus that is everywhere displaced in order to block the schizophrenic escapes and place restraints on the flights. The only modern myth is the myth of the zombies, mortified schizos, good for work, brought back to reason. I wrote a quote-unquote translation into English of that, and I'm just going to read it because I don't know that I could just off the cuff summarize what they are saying there. Zombies aren't literal here, but metaphorical, of course. They represent the people who are so controlled by capitalist imperatives that they behave like automatons, working without thinking and consuming without satisfying real needs. Zombies, in this sense, are the mortified schizos, to use their words, individuals who have been stripped of the potential for schizophrenic deterritorialization. Yet again, more jargon that they love to use. Look it up on your own. A freeing breaking away from the oppressive structures that Deleuze and Guattari valorize. That's essentially the schizophrenic deterritorialization. Try saying that three times fast. So using that basic framework, I'm just going to take a quick close read specifically here of, and I swear I'm not being pervy, but of the different dances that the strippers perform. And I think whether intentional or not, I don't know, maybe Lee's a genius. I don't want to give him too much credit. But either way, the film does engage in a critique of exploitation. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the strippers, every character. You know, the soldiers from the Z Squad, along with, we presume, how many wars are we fighting here?
Oh, goodness.
In this dystopian future. Wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Iran, Lebanon, Libya, Pakistan, Venezuela, France, Canada, and Alaska. So all those soldiers presumably caught up in those conflicts, they're being exploited for the sake of the military-industrial complex and war profiteering. The strippers themselves commodify their bodies to enrich the greedy club owners. Jessie, that you talked about before, certainly good girl, doesn't want to take her clothes off for a crowd, but she's enticed to do so because of her grandmother's, what is it, colostomy? Something to do with the butt. I don't know. And again, I think that's deliberate, and we'll talk about this in just a minute, how sometimes it's film that purports itself to be sexy is deliberately unsexy. So that there's one point actually in one of the dances where we cut to her and she's talking about this procedure. So a lot of times it really slyly pulls the rug out from under you that way. But I digress. Jesse being exploited. Paco.
Aw, Paco.
The Mexican immigrant, the custodian. Clearly there's a point being made that he's exploited, right? The first time there's a kill, he comes in, there's just blood everywhere and he's reticent to want to clean that up, and I can't blame him. And Esco, the club's owner, grabs his hand and holds it up and says, "What color is this?" referring to his skin. And then he turns around and says, "What is it? You're cleaning this entire blankety blank mess. Can you handle that? Or do I have to go find somebody else out in front of the Home Depot?"
Esco's a pig.
It is. And of course, this is deliberately being racist. Esco is deliberately portrayed that way to kind of satirize this. This is a very political film in a lot of ways. But what we see essentially, to get back to the point, is practically everyone who's not in control is in one way or another being exploited. But the film certainly intertwines the themes of stripping and zombification, which take the center stage, pun intended. Early in the film, we're treated to a lengthy striptease by Kat. Of course, that's the character played by Jenna Jameson. Followed by the shorter yet equally graphic dances by Lilith, Sox, and Jeannie. And, you know, they dance energetically. The men are into it, right? They're kind of throwing their money, but they're not, like, ecstatic the way that we see them later. The tone shifts when Kat is bitten by Sergeant Birdflu and becomes infected. But when she comes back out on the stage for that dance, it's macabre. You know, she's covered in blood. She's got these black, soulless eyes. And if you pay attention, clearly through the entire film, the decay of the women progresses and gets worse and worse. But you see it with her during the course of this one dance. She starts to get rougher looking, and that gash in her neck where she's been bitten gets more and more pronounced until when she leans back at the very end, it's almost just wide open. It should be off-putting. But the men, you know, they sit there silent. Just nobody knows what's going on at first as she's dancing. And then she kind of like slides down the pole as the music stops and she's writhing on the ground. And the men just burst in this uproarious applause and just money flying everywhere. The music kicks back in. Kat springs back to life. No pun intended that time. To resume the dance. What we see with the camera work there is very interesting. So originally in that scene, the camera is alternating between perspectives. We get Kat's perspective, side shots, and the audience perspective. All those are kind of using eye level, or what we call medium level angles. But when Kat comes back to life, so to speak, and the men start to cheer, when we cut to Kat's eye view, back to the men, you'll notice there's a Dutch angle there. If you remember, if you follow this particular podcast, you'll know I love Dutch angles. It's just when you tilt the camera slightly on its axis so that everything is just slightly skewed. A lot of times it's not very pronounced. In the case of this, I don't think it is, but it's just enough that you notice it. It kind of lets you know there's something off, something just not right. The suggestion, I think, here is that the zombie capitalist system itself is coming to life here. Again, I'm not trying to make these puns, but it's just psychologically it's really impossible for me not to. But what we do see is the camera positions change as well at this point. So we have low angle shots of Kat as she's dancing and high angle shots of the crowd, which, of course, it makes sense logically, right? Because she's on stage, she's above them, crowd is down lower. But what we see is, or what we know from these shots, particularly check out my commentary on I Know What You Did Last Summer, that close read. When you have a low angle shot, somebody sort of towering above you, they look imposing or intimidating. And the opposite is true as well. When you've got a high angle shot looking down on a person, it makes them look more vulnerable and more weak. So we see that just how completely that power dynamic has shifted. After the first round of dances, which are, I mean, let's face it, that first round you get at the very beginning of the film, it's there because people paid money to watch a film that had the word strippers in it and has top billing for a pornographic actress. But that promise of nudity and eroticism sort of fades away as the women get more grotesque in appearance.
Yeah, one of my first questions was, how is this still so popular? Like, how are the men getting even crazier about this when their bodies are literally decaying?
Well, absurdism is part of it.
Right.
But I also think absurdism makes comments on the culture writ large. And I think this commentary is on societal voyeurism and the commodification of suffering itself. The strippers deteriorate and the audience, their enthusiasm increases. Their monetary contributions highlight a troubling desensitization to human suffering, which, of course, aligns with Deleuze and Guattari's concept of people functioning like zombies under capitalism, mindlessly consuming without regard for the humanity of the performers. The strippers, even though they're dehumanized, they're more profitable as their condition worsens, illustrating the extreme exploitation inherent in certain capitalist enterprises. And that offers a scathing critique of consumerism itself and the commodification of bodies, for that matter. You know, whether it's the soldiers, Paco, or just every blue-collar worker in the world, our bodies are exploited for profit. in this particular system, and particularly with entertainment, like these strippers are like the actresses themselves. There's really no concern from the upper echelons for moral or ethical implications. So I think by making the bodies grotesque, Lee underscores the ugliness of that exploitation, forcing viewers to see beyond just the simple surface-level allure. The film comments on how society can be complicit in dehumanizing others as long as it's distanced through the lens of entertainment, or at least from sitting on the stage and looking up at someone dancing around a pole. The performances intensify. We come back in and we see the three women who are zombified dancing again, and the men are just going crazy. The club gets more and more packed. We get these vigorous gyrations, skilled pole work, seductive dance moves. But the dancers' physical decay is more pronounced as their ability, I guess, to make those moves and to perform becomes more skilled, more adept, which is, of course, ironic as well, because most zombie films, just the opposite happens. The zombie becomes slow and awkward. Right. But well, these are like super zombies, right? They're strong. Yeah. They can do flips and spin around the pole really, really fast like a helicopter. Despite all that, though, despite the decay, the audience's engagement reaches new heights. During the first dance, Kat gets up, makes her dance. Everybody goes crazy. And Jeannie, watching this, becomes incensed. So she is going to go up and dance her dance without being a zombie to show her allure, if you will. And again, I think that's the last time we get a truly, I guess for lack of a better term, erotic scene. That's an engaging, very sexually driven dance that Jeannie gives us. And whereas you think the audience would be into that, she's not a zombie. So they start to boo her and throw things at her until she's completely booed off the stage. And Kat comes back onto the stage at that point. On a meta level, if I may go there, it pushes the viewer to reflect on their own consumption. The audience in the Rhino is disinterested in a conventional erotic performance, which also prompts the actual film viewers to question why we are watching, what we're truly seeking in such films. It challenges the viewer to consider their complicity in consuming the same media that exploits and sensationalizes human bodies. Ooh, that's a mouthful, wasn't it? I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge that some of these themes I've discussed are also theoretically informed by the concept of the male gaze, most famously articulated by Laura Mulvey in her essay Visual Pleasure in Narrative Cinema. If you're interested in how that might factor in, I'll put a link on the website. There's Freud's notion of Eros and Thanatos that immediately came to mind, the idea of the intertwining of the sex and the death drives and how they come from the same place. I'm not going to get into any of that. Because this is a semi-academic exploration, as our tag says. Emphasis on the semi. So you're not in a stuffy college classroom. I'm going to spare you a deep dive into Freudian theory. We're here to enlighten, but we don't want to lead you into a state of boredom that can be described as, shall I say, zombified?
Yeah, we don't want to zombify you, even if it gives you superhuman powers.
But hey, you got a whole bunch of academic buzzwords to throw at people. You don't have to know what they say. You think Deleuze and Guattari know what they're saying?
I mean,
they may, I don't.
And I do think that, you know, one of the positive, or I guess the word I'm looking for more so is effective, one of the most effective metaphorical uses in the film of the zombies is as they gain power and influence and allure, their bodies begin to decay. And so I take that metaphorically for the more you search for power and essentially dominance over other human beings, because that's how the women are portrayed, what are you really doing to who you are as a person? Are you breaking yourself down, trying to build yourself up to a standard that is inherently toxic? And so I do think that using zombies is one of the better parts about the film.
Who doesn't love a good zombie flick?
Yeah, I love zombies. And before we move on to our next category, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor, The Rhino.
Looking for an unforgettable night out? Step into The Rhino, where the drinks are cold, the entertainment is also, let's just say it's to die for. Our dancers bring the party to life, even if they're a little less than alive themselves.
At The Rhino, you'll experience the thrill of the unexpected. From dazzling performances to our unique ambiance, it's the ultimate destination for those who crave something out of the ordinary. Enjoy signature cocktails like the Zombie Apocalypse and Reanimated Martini, crafted to perfection by our skilled bartenders.
Feeling a bit existential? Reflect on the absurdity of life with a drink in hand as you ponder whether the undead dancers are an embodiment of Sartre's bad faith or simply a reflection of Nietzsche's eternal return. Don't miss our special events, including Undead Fridays and Monster Mash Mondays.
For those seeking deeper meaning, our VIP packages offer exclusive access to the best seats in the house that might just make you question the nature of reality. Plus, enjoy a complimentary Camus Cosmopolitan as you contemplate the absurdity of existence. So, gather your friends and head down to the Rhino, where the party never dies, and neither do our dancers.
The Rhino, where nightlife meets the afterlife, and philosophy meets fun. I like those.
I like those, too. Typically, I love most hated character. It's one of the segments that I look forward to.
Softball.
Yeah, it really is. But, you know, this is difficult for me because I didn't feel very strongly about loving or hating one particular character. I guess in the film, it would have to be Madame Blavatsky because she's technically meant to support and help these women, right? But she ends up pushing their exploitation and transformation into zombies. So, yeah, I don't like her at all. I didn't like that she was pushing, essentially, death onto these girls.
But in the old country, she stripped for bread and a roof over her head.
I know.
We've got a tragic backstory.
I remember when I was once a star. Young stripper with dream. Dream to sing to swanky Parisian elite in smoky nightclub. We live for a dream.
In that tragic backstory, you know, I did feel for her for a moment, and I understood why she was where she was in life. But you just can't make someone be a zombie. That's just not right. And in the play, I guess I am upset with Daisy, because she claims to be this strong, independent person who loves Berenger out of really nowhere, but then ends up succumbing to the temptations of following the herd. So I think I was just very disappointed in her because she made it so far in the play and then ended up forfeiting her strength when it came to it.
In the film, practically everyone is unlikable. Mm-hmm. So that may be why you don't feel strongly, just because they're all terrible to begin with. You know, even I guess the two least, I don't want to say evil, the two least likely to be antagonistic, I suppose, are Jesse and Berenge. And Jesse's just so naive, it's annoying. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, we'll talk a little about her strange heel turn, back to face turn in just a minute. Berenge, she has her crisis. She comes through it. I guess it is somewhat similar to the play in that sense, but I don't know, she takes one to the coconut. She's a background player the whole time, too. You forget she's there half the time. By the way, if there's another problem with this film, it's just way too many strippers. You could have combined a couple of those into one character and shortened
it
quite
women.
A bit.
Yes. And then having the goth-type stripper named as Lilith.
Lilith.
Very original.
On the nose.
Yeah, a little too on the nose, I think. And then as we move into our next segment of Enjoy, Teach, Scholarship, when we start with Enjoy, you know, we've kind of given a little bit of already our opinions on the movie, but I really enjoyed the play. I really did.
Very good play.
I loved reading it. It makes you think, which is what I love. I love something that is a little bit meta. And the movie, no. not even a little bit. Nope. I understand that it's meant to be absurd, satirical, a comedy, but it was just too much for me.
Look, I love absurd theater. I've seen Camus and Sartre on stage, not literally them, but their plays on stage. I love Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. I love Samuel Beckett. There has to be a certain logic to the absurdity. I know how ironic that sounds, but a lot of this was just thrown out there for the sake of being thrown out there. I liked it better the first time around when I saw it, probably because A, I expected so little, and B, I just was like, ooh, I recognize that reference. That's a reference to a philosopher. There was some political satire that we're not going to get into, and I'm picking up on that. They beat you over the head with it, but it's there. Revisiting it, not impressed. As far as Teach, the play, yeah. Matter of fact, I'm actually considering, next time I teach a World Lit 2, bringing in this particular play and covering it. The film, nope, never, not in a million years. For starters, if you were to bring that film into a class, it would have to be graduate level or at the very least junior, senior level, just for the content and the subject matter. But even then, it's just not good. at all.
Yeah, teaching the play, absolutely. Some very timeless themes here in terms of social and cultural influence across humanity. I also think there's a great opportunity with introducing multiple lenses of literary theory to analyze the text, characters, themes, even syntax. And I love bringing in philosophers every now and then when I teach literature, so I think that could be a great gateway too. But the film, agreed. Not a chance. Not a chance I would teach that film. Right. It is too explicit and just doesn't have enough ties to the play either to really reference it in an academic setting at all. But with scholarship, I thought about scholarship very hard when looking at the play because I figured there has to be some articles about this play. But before I researched into the articles on it already, I really wanted to think about what would I do with this play. And that's where I kind of went into the psychoanalytic lens. But I absolutely think there's scholarship to be done with the play even further than what's already out there. There are various articles about how fascism and absurdism determine the play's themes and plot, and a few scholarly articles revolving around the theme of identity. And I was reading an interview between UNESCO and a reporter named Emmanuel Jacquart. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. If not,
the French are going to hate us.
I apologize. I'm so sorry. My southern accent, it can't.
We do have a couple of listeners in France.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I really do apologize. But
not anymore.
No, please.
S'il vous plaît.
So when I was researching these articles, I did run across an interview with UNESCO and the French name that I cannot pronounce and will not do injustice by trying. And it makes so much sense that UNESCO is the author of Rhinoceros after you hear him discuss his ideas. In one part of the interview, UNESCO expresses, quote, "The existential condition is unbearable. Well, you see what is going on around you. We come into the world crying, we end up loving the world, and then we no longer want to leave it. We are trapped. It is this mortal condition which is unsatisfying. It is having limitations that distresses me." So I feel like UNESCO focuses on this extremely psychoanalytic topic and emotion, and the themes he presents will always be applicable. Even if he is a little bit morbid about it, his outlook can be negative, and I like to think that we are not so much limited as much as we just have to seize every opportunity to make this world a better place. But I can certainly see his morbidity on mortality through his characters, now that I look back on the play with this interview in mind and just knowing that really his personal philosophy is poured into his writing, and I respect that.
Yeah, that's the play. The play absolutely deserves to be studied at length. The film? Well, in our line of work, we get trained not to make value judgments, which just means it doesn't mean if the text or the film is good or bad, excellent or putrid. Anything can be studied. When I talk about analysis in my classes, I mean, I've brought in so much stuff. I brought in lyrics to country music songs. I'm talking about, like, not the Loretta Lynn good ones. We once looked at an instruction manual for a microwave, even more shallow than all that. We once looked at a Kim Kardashian Instagram post and analyzed it. Anything can be analyzed. Anything is open for interpretation. The point is, everything is a cultural artifact. Mm-hmm. If someone took the time to create it, someone else took the time to consume it, then it makes some sort of statement about our historical point in time and the culture around it. So yeah, I could technically do something with zombie strippers. I mean, I already did, so that was almost a dissertation both you and I did. I could do that. Do I have the slightest inclination of doing it? No. You know that one scene towards the end where Jesse talks about seeing that flower growing out of the dog mm-hmm. manure and how there's something beautiful in that? Yeah, there's not even a flower growing out of this pile of turds.
Yeah, and that was so random. That was such a random moment of, like, emotional beauty.
Oh, shall we go? This may be our longest segment. Usually the WTF moment is, like, what, a minute, two minutes? Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Well, there's usually one specific thing.
Okay, some of it we can't even talk about. Pool balls. That scene. And that probably is the WTF-est of all the WTF moments in this, which is saying a lot. But there's so much more. A lot of this, like, I understand that sometimes you're filming and you have to change the script for whatever reason. You know, something doesn't work or it's not working on screen. It doesn't look right. They keep screenwriters on the set quite a bit for this very reason. clearly this film was changed in a lot of ways, and they just eventually were like, we don't even worry about continuity anymore. Let's just let it happen. Like when the zombies break out at the end and Esco is locking the club, I assumed he was outside of the club, right?
Right.
He's locking the door. He puts the key in the deadbolt and turns it and actually breaks the key off in there. And I'm like, okay, he's going to get away. But he's in the club immediately after that, and he's stuck just like everybody else.
Yeah, why, makes no sense.
Surely he didn't lock himself in.
No, he's not. He's so selfish.
That's not him. He would not do that.
Right.
Like, I could see somebody who was self-sacrificial, like, okay, I can't let anything get out.
Right.
But no, Ionesco is not that guy.
No, he is, and like you said, very intentionally, he's racist, sexist, and elitist in a lot of ways. All
germaphobe.
He wants is money. Yeah. I mean, he is, for the sake of this film, I'm sure representing a lot of evils in politics, right? But just the things he does, you just want to hit your head every time. And see, thinking about the key locking in the door, I just have to do a quick note on these sound effects.
What about the stabbing?
And the first time a knife flew, and it went boing! Boing. I was like, yes, I love this slapstick.
Whoever is the Foley on that, call me. I love you.
Yeah, it really was a joy for me because I love slapstick comedy, and so I thought that was just so funny.
Oh, what else? Another great example. At the end, why does the scientist explain this whole nefarious plot? Didn't they do that in the first, like, minute and a half? They clearly said, we created this to reanimate soldiers to fight the war because we're running out of them.
The chemovirus. Yeah, again, and I'm not trying to hate on Lee's writing because everyone's entitled to, you know, their artistic expression, but the plot holes and the cliche evil scientist doctor, you know, I was just like, that's...
Whose name, incidentally, is Cushfield. Sounds evil.
Yeah, I mean, why not? I mean, I'm very passionate about Paco.
Paco.
I know we touched on Paco a little bit, but...
If you're going to have a character who is there to sort of satirize and call attention to the way we treat immigrants and that sort of racist idea, why would you turn around and make it the most racist portrayal you possibly can?
I know.
Like, and we're not literally over the top here.
Yes.
Like he winds up in a bandolero and a sombrero with six guns, and apparently he keeps a donkey in the...
Closet. I understood the commentary up until that point. Throughout the whole film, he was disrespected, you know, and I got the political stance on how we treat immigrants. But then when this scene came, I was like, this is the over the top. I mean, it's not even satirical. It's just bad.
I don't know. It seems like they're turning around and doing the very same thing that they're critiquing
right.
in some ways. And that's disturbing.
Right. Which I think that you pointed out a quote that leads to that train of thought as well.
Yeah, the evil scientist, he lights up a cigarette and he's like, you guys should smoke more. Not enough kids smoking these days. Makes you look so blankety blank cool. And he just exhales a big cloud.
I was like, what?
And again, it's the absurdity. I get it. And they're trying to make him like super evil. But this is the end of the film, too. It's just like, where did that come from? What's the point?
I have no idea. And... I had multiple of those moments where I was like, what is the point of this? and one of them being Jessie's character. I understood that she was introduced into the film. She didn't want to do anything wrong. She took this job to pay for her Nana's surgery. And somewhere in the film, there's not even really a catalyst for this moment. She all of a sudden turns dark and she says, I want the fame. I want the lust, the admiration. I want all these things. And she says that with determination, and then 2 seconds later, she says, no, I can't stand all the killing. I can't stand idly by anymore.
It was Nana. Nana would be disappointed.
And that, to me, was just the most, like, weird, I don't know, character arc that was just put in there, I guess.
It's not about power. It's about Nana's colon.
Yeah. And I was like, good, it should be about, you know, your Nana, but... And I understood the temptation side of it. It was just so quick and so abrupt. So you didn't, I feel like, feel the emotion that maybe you were meant to feel from that crisis.
I think they'd given up at that point.
Yeah.
It just seems that way. I mean, we could keep going, but do you want to just go to geek out?
Sounds good.
When the credits rolled, I was so happy. I was geeking out. I'm joking. Let's say this kind of overlap WTF and geek out. The CGI is awful. I mean, just beyond terrible. I think a four-year-old with an iPad could do something better than this. And I know it was 2008, but we're talking like She-Hulk bad levels of CGI. Actually worse than that even, I'm joking. But the practical effects, not bad.
Yeah, I liked the prosthetics. When I first saw the, I guess, doctor who was chained to the wall who had become a zombie, I was like, okay, like that looks pretty good. But yeah, the electromagnetic guns in the hall that are like these halos of light, that was pretty bad. It hurt me because I was like, these poor people are trying to be these really cool, amazing military personnel, defeating the bad guys, and it just doesn't look good.
Stopping that, what's it called?
Oh.
Armageddon, sir.
Oh, yes. They say, what's that thing we stopped? Armageddon.
Well, the guy with the knife, what's his name?
That's my favorite guy.
Is it Riker? Is Riker the guy with the knife?
That's my favorite.
Riker stabs Satan.
That was my favorite part. He said, I like knives. And he came back later and did it, and that was funny.
But yes, the practical effects are very good. That's a couple of scenes that are hard to watch. Again, I think it's deliberate. It's so over-the-top violent. Mm-hmm. And also this ties into the way that when they're stripping, they look so grotesque. But when she takes that first guy back to do the lap dance, and we all know what happens, something that no man would ever want to experience. But if you look at just how graphic that scene is, mm-hmm. We may have to cut this, but she's chewing on the meat that she's just bit off this guy, and you can see little bits of blood squirting as she bites down on it coming out. It's so graphic. And that detail is disgusting, but it's also like kind of what you expect in a splatter kind of zombie, movie like this. When Lilith rips the guy's, bites his tongue off and rips his jaw, that looked pretty good as far as the makeup and the prosthetics. Yeah, that must be where all the money went. Speaking of which, I have a little bit of trivia there. The budget for this film was $1 million. And they actually came in under budget.
Well, I would hope so.
You could have told me the budget was $1,000 and they came in under budget and I would have believed it.
Oh,
but I think they blew it all on probably Robert Englund's salary and the prosthetics, because I don't see anywhere else that might come about.
And I'm sure he had to know a good bit about decent prosthetics with being Freddy Krueger. I mean,
he's used to being made up, that's right. For sure. He's the one that gets... I think it's a little at the end, I guess, but not much.
I mean, for the play, I guess, honestly, my geek out moment has to be Behringer's monologue at the very end of the play. I just picture it being acted out, and then looked up a few videos of different times this was acted out. And I feel like as a script, it is a really strong ending. He goes through this emotional turmoil, constantly fighting with his desire to conform, but also inherent ability to become a rhinoceros. And eventually, he decides that he'll continue to be himself. And he ends with the quote, "I am not capitulating." And I think he means that he's not going to surrender to the herd, but also that he will not surrender to the evil, self-deprecating emotions that he had just expressed. And so I just really, really loved that monologue. It was a very deep emotional moment to end the play with.
And his film counterpart, Behringer, or however they say it, when she comes out at the end, what if she was just saying, I will not capitulate. I will, because she doesn't know what all is going on outside, and then they shoot her.
That would have been great. I really would have liked that.
You should have hired me as your co-writer. Oh, well, hindsight is 20/20, right? Yes. Speaking of which, final thoughts. So back when I first saw the film, I dug it. I remember liking it. I mean, I knew it was cheesy. I knew it was low budget. Like I said before, it was a mix of low expectations and being able to spot philosophical allusions, which are now painfully obvious. I get what the director's going for. You got a low budget. You're trying to infuse the film with camp and self-awareness, give it some subtext to kind of give it some depth. There's effort. He tried. Rewatching it was painful. You know a little something about this too. That same irrational rage and anger that I feel, like right now in the sweltering Alabama sun, I feel that towards watching this film.
I want to
hit something or someone. I want to turn into a rhinoceros and stomp a cat. I don't know. It is just, I hate it. The worst part of this is people sort of know me as a connoisseur of off-the-wall films, and they like my eclectic taste. And I love this role, right? I love when people come up to me and they're like, hey, recommend a film to me that's just like bonkers off the wall that is actually good, some hidden gem. And so many times I've said, hey, try out Zombie Strippers. And I'll even tell them, you know, it's based loosely on a Comedy of the Absurd play from the 1950s. Was it Sunday or Monday night I sent you the text sincerely apologizing
yes.
to you? Because I was the one who initially chose this film. For everyone else I have ever recommended this film to, I sincerely apologize. I was wrong. I was so wrong. I don't know what was amiss with 2008 Steven, but I guess 16 more years of life experience on this mortal coil has given me some perspective. Maybe I've just turned into one of those curmudgeons who screams, get off my lawn. I don't know, but I can't express how much I dislike this film this time around.
Yeah, film, not my favorite, but was not my favorite. I was looking forward to trying to hunt down the literary ties between the film and the play because I love looking for literary nuggets in films. But there was just none in this film that went beyond the surface of like the names, for instance. And for the play, at the end of the day, I like to think that an additional theme here, especially prevalent in the ending monologue, is to not be so harsh or judgmental on yourself and also not to judge others because really, we are all battling some internal rhino of potential self-destruction.
You know, I appreciate that sentiment. I really do. But this time around, I'm going to let my inner rhino trample and judge Jay Lee on this one.
Aww.
Why, Lee? Why did you make this stinker?
Oh, poor Lee.
But what about the girls, huh? They're good girls.
They're zombies.
No, they're strippers.
They're zombie strippers.
Thank you for your continued support of Real Lit with Mackenzie and Steven. If this is your first time tuning in, be sure and check out our first two episodes where we discuss Jaws and I Know What You Did Last Summer. Whatever platform you're using to listen, please do us a favor and tap that follow button so you can be notified when a new episode drops. And if you enjoy the show, consider leaving us a rating.
Don't forget to check out Steven's solo podcast, Shelf Criticism, where each week he selects a DVD from his massive collection and gives it a critical look. What's on the docket this week?
Bridesmaids.
Ah, that's a good one.
Yeah, Kristen Wiig, Maya Rudolph.
I'm looking forward to it.
Apatow film, but this time it's women behaving badly, not men. In other words,
the
feminism.
Exception.
It's feminism.
And if you liked what you heard, please join our social media community. You can find us on Facebook by searching Real Lit Podcast, on Instagram at Real Lit Podcast, and on our official website, reallitpodcast.com. Remember, that's real, R-E-E-L, like a film reel.
And I do have some good news for us and for y'all. Next episode, unlike today, we have something genuinely watchable, actually a classic. We're hitting you with a 1952 Daphne du Maurier novella and the 1963 Alfred Hitchcock film, The Birds. Even better, big news here. We're going to be joined by our colleague, friend, and all-around expert on all things Hitchcock, Brenna. You definitely don't want to miss this one.
Real Lit is an Owls of Palace production. Our executive producer is Reagan Babb, and our theme music is Honor and Sword by Zakhar Vahala. For Real Lit, we're your hosts, Mackenzie and Steven. Until next time, keep both the reels and the pages turning.
We're done.
We got through our Lee hate session. That poor guy. I should feel bad for calling him an idiot.